Fearless Voyager Radio. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers, psychic phenomena and the unexplained, UFOs, extraterrestrial encounters, government cover-ups, alternative health care, new technologies. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
And I have with me here today, Tirone. She is a Lakota Sioux herbalist, director of the New Mexico Herb Institute in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Welcome to the show, Tirone.
Thank you.
I thought I would start out by asking a couple questions here. I guess the first and most important question is, what kind of a person uses an herbalist?
Well, our clinic's in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and we find that in my practice, I've had a clinical practice there since 1982, everybody comes. You'd be surprised. It's not just the rich people. It's not just poor people. It's not just Hispanics. We have a large Hispanic population, so they're more indoctrinated to using herbs because their grandparents did. But we see all kinds of people, mostly women. About 80% women. That's the only real difference that I see.
That's why the women are living longer, is that right?
Well, I think women have always been more concerned with health care and with their own care, but also the care of their families. So they're more open to using the plants. Plants are, you know, we've been growing side by side with plants for thousands of years. So our body is able, our biochemistry is very synergistic or very close to that of the plants. And we tolerate the plants very well without side effects and without harmful allergic reactions. And so people use herbs because they're much safer than the pharmaceutical products on the market today.
You mentioned a term. You said that there are spirits in the plants. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Is that a way to say it? Could you mm-hmm. comment on that or explain that to me?
Well, I guess the easiest way is to just sort of tell you a little bit how I learned about them. When I was quite small, I was around 6 years old, I used to go help my grandfather collect plants. Of course, he collected them. I carry them because I wasn't allowed to pick them at the time unless they were for food. And so I was toting around this bag and following him around. And one day he had me sit down in front of this plant and he told me just to sit there. And when he came back, he wanted me to tell him everything that I saw about that plant. So I did. I was a little child. I was about 6.5 years old. And I looked at that plant and, you know, I wanted to please my grandfather. So I really looked at that plant. He came back at the end of the day and he asked me what I saw. So I was describing in a 6.5 year old vocabulary what I saw that plant. You know, it was green and about this tall and what it looked like. He seemed a little disappointed, and so we marched back there the next day, and we did the same thing over and over for quite a few days until I was crying all the way there, feeling like I was being punished for having to sit there all day and look at this plant. And that day, after about probably 10 days of going out and sitting in front of this stupid plant all day long, which was how I felt at that time, I was laying there and I laid back and I was looking and I was crying. I was looking up at the sky and I was thinking about my mother who had left when I was quite small and I didn't have a lot of memory of her. And I saw her as this beautiful blonde woman. My mother was white and green eyes and very soft and fragile, and I just had this very clear image of my mother. Well, Tunkashla came back, my grandfather came back later on that afternoon and asked me what I saw, and I'm crying and I said, I didn't see anything. I'm tired of sitting here. I don't want to be with you anymore. And he said, you don't think about anything when you're there. You don't see anything when you're sitting there. And I looked at him, and I was crying, and I told him I dreamed. I said I was thinking of my mother. And so he looked at me, and he said, what did you think about when you thought about your mother? And so I described what I had seen. The next day, we went back, and he gave me his digging tool to dig up the plant, which I knew was like a real honor. I'd never picked a medicinal plant before. When we picked the plant, and I took the plant out of the ground, it had these small red roots all in the bottom. They were very, very thin. They looked like very small blood vessels. And I held them in my hands, and I knew that it was something, you know, really wakan, that it was something really, you know, holy or powerful. And he looked at me and he said to me very gently, because obviously I wasn't getting what I was supposed to be getting. He said, you know, we use this plant for women who are bleeding a lot, for very pale women, women that are very weak, very fragile. And he said, what you saw yesterday was not your mother. He said, your mother's very big, very strong, very loud, powerful woman, tan skin. He said, what you saw was the spirit of the plant that was teaching you its medicine. And he said, the only way that an Indian should learn medicine is by going and experiencing each plant itself. And he and I have sat in front of plants for weeks and not gotten a thing. And so I figure that it's not my plant to use. It's not my medicine. And when you learn about plants in this way, when the spirit teaches you actually the herb and what it's for, then you don't give people the wrong medicine. You don't use it unwisely, because it shares with you its secrets and how to use it. So that's what I'm referring to, the spirits of the plants, is because they all have their own spirit energy that can teach you if we're just willing to listen.
One of the areas that you spoke about today was stress-related problems, and I would imagine that not only do you talk about the stress-related problems, but you must also include some of the medicinal remedies. Remedies.
That's correct.
Maybe you could comment on that for the listeners.
First of all, before I say anything about individual herbs, I would just like to be real careful that, because you can treat herbalism almost as an allopathic substitute, instead of just if you've got this symptom, you just use this herb, you know, to get rid of the symptom, and you might as well just take an aspirin or a pharmaceutical medication to do that. I prefer to practice in a holistic fashion, which means that we recognize that the whole is more than just a sum of their parts, and that the individual is so deeply connected between their physical and their spiritual being that there is no separation, and that when one level is affected, the other level is always affected as well, because it's constantly interfacing. Stress, you know, in my clinic I find that stress is, there isn't anybody that comes in with a problem that doesn't have stress in their lives. I see headaches, neuromuscular problems that require a lot of massage type of work, PMS, which is premenstrual syndrome in women before their menstrual cycles.
So you relate PMS as definitely a stress disorder.
Oh, I think you can't simplify it that much, but well, it definitely has a large component to our emotional health and our emotional outlook, and stress is a big contributor to it. You've got women that, you know, that have to be super women. You know, they have to work a job, they have to raise the kids, they have to go grab the groceries, do the laundry, and work 8 to 5, and it's impossible, and it shows, and it shows on many levels. And one of the first places it shows is in the reproductive tract, because if anything's going to go wrong, nature's way of providing that women don't become pregnant when they're not healthy is to start messing up the reproductive system. So it's the first thing that goes. And so it's very common when I see somebody under stress that they're having problems with their menstrual cycle.
Well, let's take one stress-related problem here.
Migraines.
Well, I don't know migraine headaches. I'm almost afraid to touch that one because I don't know very much about it. But if you feel comfortable with that, let's do it.
Well, a migraine, there's some real common things you can do for it. A migraine headache is simply when the artery in the brain constricts and then dilates. And as it dilates in the brain, the stretching of the artery wall causes pain. And so many people are photosensitive. They can't take the light. They don't want to have any sound. They want to be locked into a dark room with Demerol and just leave me alone. And there's a lot of things you can do for migraine headaches that have been clinically researched. Feverfew is excellent. Drinking a Feverfew acts as a prophylactic.
Now, wait a minute. Wait, let's fever.
Feverfew, just what like fever and then few. It's a plant. Feverfew leaf is used. And if you drink this tea every day, it helps many people act as a preventative for migraines. People with migraines need to really watch caffeinated drinks. Things such as nitrates, which dilate the blood vessels, which is already the problem if you're having migraines, so you have to watch anything with nitrates.
So just
in
with
it.
Those three things now, here we are talking holistically. Mm-hmm. Nitrates, of course, are located in foods.
Right.
So people need
hot dogs.
Right. People need to watch foods. Well, of course,
I heard once
if you cut meat out of your diet totally, you would definitely take care of a lot of problems.
You bet. The fever.
The tea, and mm-hmm. then of course we talked about the biggest thing of all, colas and teas and coffees here in the United States, certainly, which are crammed with caffeine, and then of course aspirin, which someone would normally take for a migraine if they didn't know, and that contains a tremendous amount of caffeine.
Right.
All right, so continue. I just thought I'd comment on that. So right away we're looking holistically just in that little area.
Right, exactly. And diet is a big part. Dairy products, shellfish, red wines, you know, red wine, sherry, port, are deadly to people that suffer from migraines. So all of these things really need to be avoided in the diet.
Now, do standard physicians talk about this?
Well, hopefully...
I don't know.
No, but hopefully we're moving towards more enlightened physicians who will get more training in school. I'm applying to med school this fall and to get my MD.
You're going the reverse. Now you're going to be an herbalist who will become a doctor and then be recognized, let's say, by the AMA,
and then using that practice,
you'll come back and use herbs that everyone says, instead of saying, oh, you're just an herbalist and give you no credibility, you can say, I may be an herbalist, but I'm also a doctor.
That's right.
Love it.
And I'm recognized by my peers, physicians. But I found at UNM, at University of New Mexico, which is common of most medical schools, 3 hours of nutrition in 4 years of school. So can you really blame a lot of physicians because this is the training that they get? No, a lot of them are very unaware of the dietary ramifications with many illnesses and what needs to be avoided.
Well, we're in a quick fix mode, although I notice it seems that we're coming out of it
to some degree, as far
as doctors are concerned, but we're still in a quick fix mode as far as people, because we dictate to our doctors what we expect of them.
Instant gratification.
Right.
Anything that can instantly gratify the senses, and you have the flip side of that same coin. You know, if we're having pain, we want something that will get rid of it real quick, which denies the person the total experience of going through the illness and looking at all aspects of their lives where they can really make some positive changes. And lifestyle changes are the hardest changes to make. And when you start talking to people about food, you know, they've been in control of food since they were 2 years old. You couldn't make Johnny eat his broccoli. You know, not really, if he didn't really want to eat it. And so it's that basic kind of thing everybody feels that they have control over is their food. And when you start talking about that they need to cut this out of their diet and this out of their diet, you're really asking people to make major lifestyle changes, which are positive. You don't want to get stuck in a rut. A lot of people, you know, they're afraid of change, and it's positive.
I got away for a moment from migraine. Was there anything else that you felt was very important with migraine?
Feverfew is the big herb that should be taken, and you want to watch for yeast. That's just another one that I found. A lot of people have yeast sensitivities, and getting massage therapy.
So certain types of bread, you would probably want a flatbread then.
Right. Tortillas from New Mexico. Yeah. So flour tortillas, corn tortillas. So, and massage therapy. I can't stress enough how important that is for treating people with these type of problems as well.
Neuromuscular problems, what would that entail?
Well, at our workshop today, what we were basically covering was just tight muscles, you know, a lot of stress, tension that is held in the muscles. People often come to me, they look like they've been doing isometric exercises for 10 years. They're just so tight in this constant state of constriction. And to be able to move and move properly, that's a balance of constricting muscles and relaxing muscles in how we move. And it's very important to teach people to relax. And you've got wonderful nervine relaxants in the herb kingdom, valerian, skullcap, passion flower, lemon balm. I mean, there's a whole group of nervine relaxants that are so wonderful to take to help relax the body and keep it calm and keep those, you know, shoulders off your ears. So that's basically what we were talking about today.
Insomnia, I see, I hear always that people have trouble sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Passion flower is one of the best. It's safe, can be taken by anybody, doesn't taste really bad. You can take it in a tincture form. People don't take enough, you know, if you get passion flower tincture.
A tincture form would be like...
An alcohol extract.
Uh-huh. Would that be something like a Bach flower remedy or something like that?
No, these are herbal. These are full-strength herbal.
Now, what is a Bach flower remedy versus an herb?
Well, it's a vibrational essence of a plant, of
which
a flowering
one?
Plate, a Bach flower.
Okay.
Herbal medicine, in the use that I'm talking about, is not in a homeopathic sense. It's in full strength.
And it's basically
potent,
always
medicinal.
A tea?
It can be teas, or it can be a tincture, it can be an extract. It can be in suppositories. It can be in douches. I mean, in enemas. There are many forms that you can use herbs in.
Anxiety. Mm-hmm. How about anxiety? What do we have here?
Well, you could take your Bach flower rescue remedy for anxiety that you were just mentioning. It's wonderful for anxiety mm-hmm. and stress like this.
But from an herbalist.
We use three herbs, gotocola, damiana, and oat straw, which is a wonderful combination of these three herbs mixed together in equal parts, taken in a tea for anxiety. And there are a few people out there, and counseling is important. I don't want to deny the benefits of counseling for people that have real anxiety attacks. You know, a teacher that's sitting in front of a third grade class teaching a class and just has to go sit down and has an empty pit in the stomach and sweaty palms. You know, counseling needs to be addressed too, but we have found that high B-complex vitamins and this combination of gotocola, damiana, and oat straw has been extremely effective in treating people both with anxiety and depression. Both.
Let's jump from the stress-related problems over to the immune system for a moment. Big areas, you mentioned this before, AIDS, cancer, flu, fevers, arthritis. Why don't you run through a few of those and tell me a little bit about some of the research that you've seen
mm-hmm.
and what are some of the hopes and realities that we live with those particular immune system problems?
Well, I think we have to be very realistic in the day and age that we live in. Our immune system is under constant assault from the toxins in our food, in our water, in the air that we breathe. I heard that that there are traces of pollutants in Nepal, that even in this area in the vegetation, you can find pollutants. It's unavoidable, which means that we're constantly under stress, our immune system. Our emotions play a big part of our immune health. Studies that were done at Harvard Med School with spouses who've had other spouses die, somebody in their 60s and their husband dies, they've done 36-month follow-ups and found that many, many of the spouses died within 36 months. And their reasoning was because grief really does depress the immune system, and we tend to hold in our grief and not express it, so it even compounds it. Immune system, it varies. You know, more people, a lot of older people, listeners will remember that more people died of influenza after the First World War than died during the war. These are all immune system. When the immune system is working fine, then your internal body is in a state of homeostasis, and it maintains this balanced level inside no matter what. When the immune system gets out of kilter, well, then you start having all kinds of problems with disease and illness. So as far as I'm concerned, whenever you're treating an illness, you must address the immune system. It doesn't matter what it is. You must address the immune system and use things like echinacea. Echinacea is you know, one of the herbs. It's been studied tremendously in Europe. They're so far ahead of us in herb research than the United States. But echinacea has been found clinically that what it does is stimulate the production of macrophages in the body. That's a part of the immune system. And this is what sends out the gamma interferon and the interleukin-1, which get the T4 helper cells going. So this is a great herb to take to stimulate the immune response in the body. It also has been found clinically to be antiviral as well as antibacterial. And there are many of your pharmaceutical antibiotics that are not antiviral. They do not work against viruses, just against bacterial infections. So I think you're going to see a lot more on the forefront with echinacea, but I swear by it in our clinic.
The question, I guess, then, that a lot of people have is that just like flu is out there all the time, mm-hmm. and is being passed on by touching someone, that seems to be one of the things we're discovering about flu. Is that correct?
Well, my whole philosophy is real different than traditional American Medical Association.
Well, I didn't say that you would get it.
Right.
Okay, if the immune
system...
It's
always there.
Okay.
Viruses are always, always there. And yes, you can get them through many ways, and touching is one of them, especially in children, playing with toys and coughing on things and then passing them to other children who put them in their mouths and who...
But as we have always noticed, some children get flu and others don't.
Mm-hmm.
What I was going to say was that it seems to me that perhaps... all of this research with AIDS, especially linking it, for example, always to how you contract it and how it's passed, what we're really talking about here is if the immune system mm-hmm. was correct, if it was in homeostasis, like you say, then are you saying that AIDS would not continue? Or is that, I don't know if that's strong. Would you say that there would be a better possibility that it wouldn't be continuing the way it is now?
I think that it's not an either-or situation, but I think that there would be much less illness all around of all types of illnesses, including AIDS and including cancer, if the immune system was in health, but how are you going to have healthy individuals until you have a healthy community or a healthy society? Our society does not promote good health. That's not part of its function. And hospitals have not been designed to promote health. Doctors have not been taught to promote health. They've been taught to treat sickness. And there's a big difference between promoting health and treating sickness.
Real quickly, there's a native constitutional body typing that you do mm-hmm. in your institute. Can you give us a rough idea as to what this means?
It's real similar to Chinese or Ayurvedic medicine. There's a use of the four directions, and if you have a northerly constitution, somebody that tends to be a bit cold and austere, I mean, you've all met people, and they'll sit more off to themselves. They're a little bit forbidding in their nature. When they become ill, you usually have to use herbs from the south, things from the fire that are fiery in their nature, southern constitution type remedies to strengthen that, and vice versa. Somebody that's very hot, very fiery in a southern constitution usually tend to be leaders and tend to be powerful people, but they also tend to have an addictive personality, and so you use herbs from the north to cool and to pacify people of this constitution. What I'm trying to say is that it upsets me at times for people to look at Chinese medicine or Ayurvedic medicine and feel that these, and they are wonderful systems, but because Native Americans or Indians have had an oral tradition, somehow it's less valid or it's somehow less real. Constitutional typing has been used by most Native American tribes throughout history, through their medicine men. And each herb, if you're using a root, it's considered earth energy, and if you're using the flowering tops, it's considered sky energy, and those relate to father energy and mother energy, respectively. And these, if somebody's needing sky energy, father energy, it means that they need to be uplifted. They need to be brought up. Somebody needs to be grounded, then you want to give them a root. And often, roots and the top's part of the plant, it's hard to decide. If you've got five herbs that'll do the same thing for an individual, constitutional typing has to be what decides what herb is going to be used for that individual, so you'll have true healing take place.
So the difference... kind of in summing up herbalist remedies is that when you have a remedy, the remedy is not the same for everyone.
Exactly.
Which is the way physicians are treating now. But rather, each person, or let's say four types, are treated differently according to their type.
Mm-hmm. Everybody's unique and individual and has to be. That's why when you refer to like cancer patients or AIDS patients, sort of makes me cringe, because they're each individuals. They're all individuals and must be addressed and looked at separately. And what happens when you have a physician that can only spend 10 or 15 minutes of his time with a patient is that there's not time to really spend with them and determine constitutional typing and their special needs. So it's a tough question.
This has been a very informative interview, Tirone. I wish we had more time. I don't. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the Timeless Voyager show. And I certainly look forward to maybe talking to you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.